Just one little addendum to the announcements. I do want to express our appreciation for all that Dave Hershberger does for the congregation with the sound and webcast, all the technical aspects that he oversees. Thankfully, we function in his absence while he is trying to recuperate from his bad back, because he trained a bunch of our young people to be able to run that stuff. And I know that most of us who are several scores of years old or thereabouts are just as glad that the young ones understand how it all functions. He even, we had a little blip in the Bible study webcast last night. I had this pop-up ad for a program I don't use and don't want, but it pops up right in the middle of the webcast, which then cuts the webcast off. I don't know why it does that, but that's because I'm not Dave Hershberger. He knows why. Anyway, but he wasn't there. He was working remotely, monitoring it remotely from his computer. So we're going to try to fix that little blip. Anyway, what he did is he spliced the two pieces together, so if you want to watch it without wondering where did he go, will he come back, you know, what was the point we were covering, all those sorts of things. So you can go back and watch it. We do put those Bible studies right up on the local website, and all you have to do to find them is go to sermons, which is perfectly logical, isn't it? Bible studies, go to sermons. All the Bible studies and all the sermons are in the same section of the website. So that's why that's the way it is. Today I want to talk about God as our shepherd. That's the title, God is our shepherd. And do a little reflecting. As you see, I waxed eloquent in some kind of a poem in the announcements. Couldn't think of anything else to write, but that started coming to mind as I thought about going back to the home place. My brother lives within a mile of our farm. His middle daughter and her husband actually own the old home site on the farm. The farm went bankrupt years ago, but my folks retained 12 acres, so they bought those 12 acres from them. And so we can actually go back to the place we lived for so many years. Not where we were born, we were from Nebraska, but we lived more years in South Dakota by far than we did in Nebraska. So you start thinking about that and thinking about the agricultural lessons of God's way, and you realize, you know, we do have an edge on the high techies. They don't know a thing about shepherds and cows and well, I can't say that because, in fact, some do Google them and they know what they look like. Others, in fact, do know something about it. But generally speaking, in society, we know less and less about the agricultural rhythms of life, even in agriculture, because we have farmers now that hardly ever turn a wrench. They have somebody that they hire to do either wrench turner when anything needs to be fixed. They hardly ever deal with livestock. They might feed the dog or the cat, but we are a grain-based agricultural or a nation now. We've always had large feedlots. I mean, for a long time we have. And if you live downwind of them, they were a bane, as they don't smell good. Cattle, hogs, or sheep, and when you have too many thousands of them all in one big pen. But that has become the norm. There are fewer and fewer actual ranchers raising the livestock that is going to be fattened up so we can eat it. Fewer and fewer that are involved in sheep. Likewise, more and more involved in hogs. But still, on a massive factory farming basis. Likewise, the cropping is done with monster tractors. I don't know if you pay too much mind to it, but having grown up on a farm, I'm watching the fields all the time when I'm driving anywhere. Here in Montana, or here in Ohio, or down in Montana, or wherever we happen to be driving, I'm always looking at the fields and looking for the farm equipment to see how big it is, and mourning the fact that we don't have pheasants anymore, or quail. And there's one good reason. We don't have fence rows anymore. See, pheasants and quail used to nest in the fence rows that ran down through the pastures or down through the fields. The fences aren't there anymore. It's not like they put in a new fence and there's not any brush grown up. No, they don't have fences. They ripped those out so that they could pull bigger equipment behind those gigantic tractors and make them faster and more efficient. Now, they could have left them in, and they could still go up and make two rounds, and they'd be done with the field. But, no, they want to, you know, put it in. Instead of going 4 or 5 miles an hour, they want to do 6 or 7 or 8. And they can do it with those monster tractors. And they can maneuver and accomplish all of that really fast. But at what expense? We've lost an awful lot of the natural life that we have always enjoyed, that the local farms grew inadvertently, just through fence rows and things like that. They haven't managed to stop the deer population, however, so we still have a lot of venison running around. But it's a sad thing when we lose the rhythms of agriculture. Therefore, sometimes it's good to go back and try to recapture the rhythms of growing things that God established. And I understand the technology, I understand the value of the bigger tractors and all of those things. I've studied all that and understand it thoroughly. But it's still overall not a good thing. We have sped up to the point that we don't think deeply. We don't analyze the wisdom that comes off the soil or out of the soil and off out of the woods. We don't think about that anywhere near as much as even when those who of us who are middle-aged were young. There's a lot more of that then. So, excuse me, periodically we need to go back and think about those things. We're going to look in this sermon, God is Our Shepherd, in Psalm 23. And 77, 78, 4, and 78, and 79, and 95, and 80. And a bunch of other scriptures. But we're going to start with Psalm 23. Psalm 23. Probably the first one that growing up, even in God's church, that you remembered something of. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. And maybe, like me, you wonder, why don't I want God to be my shepherd? You know, what's wrong with that? It puzzled me for the longest time. And then somebody explained, when it says, I shall not want, it doesn't mean you don't desire him to be your shepherd. It means that you won't lack anything. There will be cereal in your cereal bowl and milk in your glass at the dinner table. Oh, it actually took me till I went to college and I understood how they use the word want in the King James concept, and they translated it, brought it straight over into the New King James, because it is so much a part of this hymn, probably psalm is a hymn. This is probably one of the most quoted parts of Scripture, as far as an entire section, a chapter, or in this case an intact psalm, is the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. Now remember, David wrote this. If you go back up to the top, it says in little print, it says right before the first line, a psalm of David. Usually it's been put in italics or some other font than what the rest of the scripture is. But that is part of the scripture. It identifies it as a psalm that David wrote. It's in the first book of, there are five books of Psalms, in five sections of the big book that we call Psalms. And this is in the first one, which are basically all Psalms of David. Then there are other Psalms that he wrote sprinkled throughout the rest of the book of Psalms. So that superscription is what that is called, and that identifies sometimes who wrote it. Most of the Psalms have them. There are a few that don't, but most of them do. It gives you a little bit of an insight of the time and the setting, or the, what do they call it in the antiques business, provenance of the Psalm. Looking back, a Psalm of David. Ah, King David wrote this one. Why would King David write about being a shepherd? Well, we already know that. Because if we've memorized some of the details of any biography of the Bible, we know something about David. And there'll be a few others, of course, about Christ. But mostly David is the other one that we know. We know that when he was young, he was a shepherd. And when Samuel went to anoint him as king, he didn't get to anoint any of his older, bigger, stronger, theoretically more handsome brothers, or theoretically more capable, because they weren't. And David was the one that God wanted. David was the youngest. And he had to be brought in from out in the sheep pasture, because he was out looking after the sheep near Bethlehem. So he understood this. David wrote this psalm, this poem, as a reflection of what he knew. Also, it was inspired by God. Now, mine and my little poem, which is a reflection of my memories of growing up there in South Dakota, is not inspired by God, which is why it has grammatical mistakes in a couple of spots. I apologize for those. But David's didn't. The Eternal is my shepherd, I shall not want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside the still waters. Why does a shepherd make his flock lie down in green pastures? Shouldn't they eat the green pastures? Well, yeah, that kind of goes without saying, doesn't it? But he doesn't stress them. He doesn't pressure them too much. He wants them periodically to lie down, to be calm. So they eat their fill, and then they flop down. Now, you ever watch a quadruped get down into a sleeping position or resting position? Normally, they go to their knees, and then they'll bend their hocks. That's their hind knees, which bend the other way. They'll bend them back and pull their bottom of their legs up, and they'll sort of fold down. And then when they get up, the different ones, how big they are, depends on whether they push up with their front legs or get up on their hind legs or whatever. But they have a way of lying down. So they eat their fill of the green pastures, and then they've got to process that. Remember, you can only eat so much if you're a cud chewer, because then you have to lay down and relax and burp up everything you ate. One huge mouthful at a time. Each mouthful is called a cud, and you chew your cud, and that's what makes you a prime target for a dinner table, because you have a cloven hoof and you chew your cud, so you're clean to eat by humans, as God reckons it. And God is the one who does reckon it. So they lie down to do that. Usually they're lying down chewing their cud. Once in a while, you'll find an animal that likes to stand. You know, there's individuals and chew their cud. But it's always was fun to watch. I like to watch them burp them up. And you can see that big wad of grass coming back up. You can't see it, but you can see the swelling in the neck as they irp it back up. And then they happily just sit there and chew sideways, you know, over and over. And they don't have many teeth, you see, so you have to reprocess it. And that's the way cows do it and the way sheep do it. And probably put you off your lunch, but so what? We can always eat lunch again later. And then chew on it some more. But that's the problem. That's why they have to lie down in the green pastures. You don't want them running after they eat. You want them to feel good and lie down and gain strength. And you're trying to put weight on an animal because in the modern marketplace, you want nice, fleshy animals, heavy animals, because they're worth more on the market. They sell them by the pound. So you want them to not be stressed. You want them to be happy eating and putting on weight and getting big and strong and so on, so that they'll make people big and strong at the dinner table. He goes on to say, because the Lord is my shepherd, he makes me to lie down in green pastures. So he's talking about himself as being like the sheep that lie down and chew their cud. He restores my soul, you know, inside out. God restores us, encourages and strengthens us. He leads me in the paths of righteousness. When we do wrong things, we can't blame God for it. God didn't lead us there. See, we get recalcitrant periodically, and we want to run off and do something that we know we shouldn't do. And then sometimes we do it. We need to repent of that, because God didn't lead us to do that. And we can't blame, oh, the Lord made me want to, you know, max out my credit cards on ice cream and donuts. You know, I was just thinking as I drove by Dunkin' Donuts this morning, why is it Dunkin' Donuts? And I thought, oh, they dunk their donuts in their coffee. But I also know that Dunkin' Donuts has a better quality coffee than they used to. So they really aren't Dunkin' Donuts anymore, if the coffee's as good as they say. Because the reason you dunk donuts in the coffee is what? Coffee tastes awful. But you can get it down if it's soaked up in a donut. You ask the firemen and the cops to drink the stuff. You know, before Starbucks, they didn't know that coffee could actually have Wow, flavor. So they dunked whatever they had in their hand inside the coffee to sort of give it a pastry flavor, which improved the coffee. Going back, though, he leads me beside the still waters. Still waters are where the sheep need to get their drink, the streams, not the wild raging rivers. That's not safe for sheep. Much better still waters, pools, ponds, or where a stream eddies out because it's the lay of the land flattened slightly. That's a great place to water them. He leads me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. So as David led his sheep, that he's drawing the analogy of how God led him. And how God led King David is how he leads us. God is our shepherd. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. Now, there are areas around any pasture that are dangerous for sheep. And sheep are not as cunning as cattle. That's a respectful way of saying it, I think. So they tend to get themselves in more trouble. Occasionally, cattle will get into trouble, too. But they need to be watched over so that they don't get into the valley of the shadow of death. There's a book that was written by a man who was a shepherd, and he did some geographical research of the area around Jerusalem where the shepherds would have had their flocks. David's would have been, he tended to focus down in the Dead Sea area, if I remember correctly as I read those books, whereas David was up by Bethlehem, which is the other direction, and further south from Jerusalem. But whatever the case, there are always dangerous places for sheep to get into. Dangerous places for cattle to get into, and a shepherd has to watch out for that. I remember one day we were haying our stock cows, and they were in the middle of calving, and we had them in a pasture. We had a swamp that was in a ravine, and they had a trail they walked down in along the cattails to get to the tank because there was a spring. The spring, we set it up to fill the tank constantly and then run it over the tank so they had nice fresh water. And I came around to get a load of hay across the ravine. We had some of our hay stored. And there was a cow laying on her back with her feet in the air. She'd fallen into this trail of mud off of a slope and landed on her back, and she couldn't get flipped over because they had trenched out the trail because they used it all the time. And it was during calving time, so then I figured out exactly right away what the problem was. She was trying to have a calf on the slope, and as she was straining, she had laid down wrong and she rolled and landed on her back. So we had to scramble. That was a dangerous place for her to be. That was her valley in the shadow of death. She didn't die. We lost the calf. We had a tractor there and a log chain, and that was the only way to try to save her life is we put a chain around her neck. She didn't have horns, and then we eased her up out of that, and dragged her literally up the slope with me pushing a little bit behind her, until we had a reasonably flat spot. And we had to pull the calf. As I said, it was dead. But then the cow was in danger of hypothermia because it was a cold spring. So we went and got some old bales of hay that we weren't feeding anymore. They were a couple of years old, but they were dry. And we put them in a ring around her, and we torched the bales of hay. She went nuts. Literally, she went nuts. They don't like being in the middle of a ring of fire. Most animals don't. And this poor cow, she'd lost her calf, and now she was going to burn up and die. It was the worst imaginable thing, but she got warm, and she survived. But her eyes always bulged out from laying on her back for so long. We took care of her. We brought her up to our corral system by the house, and she would raise her calves up there where we could keep a good eye on her. She ended up raising, 8 or 10 calves. She's a real good stock cow, but she was nuts. She was in our milk cow corral, and she couldn't see well because her eyes bugged out from lying upside down. So we called her the bug-o-eyed mean cow. Because for no provocation, we're just sitting there milking our cow or doing whatever chores we were doing, she decided we shouldn't be there. She never do it, only when she had her calf with her. And the rest of the year, she was fine. So then she would come running, snorting and running, charging us. Well, all right. You know, we were kids, and it was part entertainment and part danger. So you just grab your bucket and drop your milk stool and vault over the fence. Get out of her way. She'll calm down, and then you can go back and finish milking the cow. Our cows would just stand wherever they were and be milked. But we saved her life, she, from the shadow of death, because she would have died left like that. Sheep die quicker than cows. Sheep, sometimes it seems like they die for no particular reason. Like, there is a reason, but it's not particular, unless you're a sheep expert. My brother was one. We had a neighbor who raised a lot of sheep, but he never bothered with the shepherding part. And he finally got out of the business because his death loss was too high. He'd complain that, you know, these sheep, they just lie down and die for no reason. Well, there was always a reason, and just that he wasn't down checking on them regularly enough to know what it was and to get it fixed. David understood all of the processes of raising livestock and working with them. In particular, sheep were what he did. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil. You're with me. His sheep were, he was with his sheep, and they were calm and at peace because their shepherd was there. But he was looking to God and making himself the sheep. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. Those were David's shepherding tools. The rod was like a club, walking staff club, and they were, well, more of a club than anything else. And then the staff was for capturing a sheep. They would steam a crook in the end of it, so if it didn't have one naturally, and you could reach out and catch a sheep as it's going by around the neck, and you pull it over to yourself to take burrs out of the fur, or, you know, if it's got a limp, what's wrong with your foot? We're going to look at that foot, so you go and catch it like that. That's a lot easier than chasing them around and around and around until you can grab the wool, or more terrifying for a sheep, get the lariat out and rope them around the neck. They don't do that. Calves are fine, but sheep don't like being roped very well. So the staff was a real easy, calm way to work with sheep. And my brother even had a calmer way. He had a staff that he used sometimes, but other times he'd just walk through the crowd of the sheep with his eye on the one he needed to see. And when he got up beside it, he just grabbed a fistful of fur, and it wasn't going anywhere. And then he would turn it over or get the burrs out or whatever needed to be done, whatever doctoring needed to be done to make that sheep well. David goes on to talk about a table being prepared before him in the presence of his enemies. Well, there are tables that are prepared before the sheep by the shepherd. And the sheep are always have their enemies. They have big hawks. That's one of the difficulties of having bald eagles in the West. They eat lambs. They all come down and take a lamb. Not a monster lamb, but anything they can haul off. The baby lambs are only as big as a big jackrabbit to start with, and a hawk can take that, but an eagle will take them even larger than that. But that's not what your main worry is. Your main worry is coyotes, which are prairie wolves. My brother was death on coyotes. He was able to raise sheep. When he got into farming, this was while I was at Ambassador College, he's a couple of years younger than me, then when he got out of high school, he decided he would go ahead and farm with my father, but he was able to purchase his own place, not about 5 miles away, and he liked sheep. And he had learned sheep raising from a local shepherd who was a sheep rancher too, and he wanted to raise sheep, so he did. In order to raise sheep, you had to have a varmint rifle and how to use it, because we had lots of coyotes. And he thinned their populations significantly anywhere within 30 miles of his place. And I remember one day we were visiting, and we were driving back from the city, Rapid City, and we were about 30 miles from home, and he said, "There's a coyote out in that pasture. I'm going to shoot it." I said, "You can't shoot it. This is a state highway." He says, "They don't care. It's not against the law as long as you don't shoot across it." And I looked it up later. He was right. So he unraveled the varmint rifle, but the coyote realized that there was something up there on the highway, and he beat a hasty retreat and got out of sight. There were many who didn't. One night he was coming back from my Paris place. They're about the 5 miles away, wasn't far, with his wife and their two oldest daughters, who were just little tykes at the time, sitting in between them in the pickup seat. and he stopped at a spot where there was an irrigation canal down off into an empty field away from all the other building sites around. The coyotes traveled that, so he flipped on his 1 million candle powered light, the one that you plug into the cigarette lighter back in, this is in the early 80s. Sure enough, there was a coyote right out there. And so he hollered for his wife to grab the light, so she reaches across to the daughters, holds the light out the window, and the coyote's running now. He unravels his varmint rifle, and on the run, in the dark, just lit by the light, it rolled. And that was only 2 miles from his flock. And he had to shoot coyotes in the flock. A coyote will get into a flock, and it'll kill not one lamb and eat it, or one sheep. It will kill in a frenzy, especially if there maybe are more than one coyote there, because the sheep are running around and the predator gets excited, and so it runs around biting, wounding, or killing multiple animals. We know of ranchers that reported having 25 sheep in a night killed that way. And they could tell what did it by the tracks and the tooth marks. So you have to protect your flock. David did. You know the story? He told Saul this when he was going to go up against Goliath, that he had killed a bear and a lion who had come up against his flock, after his flock. And they had a lamb in their mouth in either case, and he ran over there and smacked them. And they dropped the lamb. Now, I'm presuming he would use his rod, which was a club, and run toward this giant carnivore and then hit it as hard as he could in the back of the head and make it drop that lamb before it killed it. But David wasn't going to let it get away. He would have carried a sheath knife in his belt. He then grabbed it by its beard and smote it, as it says in the King James. And the smoting was done with a knife, and he killed the animals. Now, the Middle Eastern or Near Eastern, Middle Eastern is a modern term. Near Eastern is the older one. The Near Eastern lions were basically the same as the African lions, only they maxed out at about 350 pounds. African lions will max out around 500 pounds. So they're just a larger version of the Middle Eastern one. And but still, taking on a lion that weighs 300, 350 pounds, barehanded except for the knife and the club, David was no shrinking rosebud. Sorry, violet. No shrinking violet. I knew it was a flower, by any means. The bear was a Syrian black bear. As far as we know, it's the same species they have now in the Near East. And it looks just like our black bears in America, only the hair is a little bit longer, and it has kind of a white crescent of some sort on, typically around the collarbone area. But it has a reputation for being more aggressive than our black bears. Never trust a black bear. Some of them aren't highly aggressive, but you never know when they decide that peer pressure is just too much for them and they're going to be aggressive. So the ones David dealt with were worse than that. David knew that his sheep grazed in the shadow of death, and he watched over them. You prepare a table in the presence of mine enemies, and you anoint my head with oil. My cup runs over. And we think, well, how is David preparing a table for his sheep? Well, he does. Any shepherd does. They go out and they look at their sheep and they look at what the pastures have, and then they lead the sheep to the part of the pasture that has what they need. Those who are really good with understanding even the medicinal quality of herbs will know where those herbs grow in the pasturage that they use their sheep for. And they'll move them in to make sure that they're taking some of that in. So you don't just turn them loose, you stay with them through the day in David's time. So he was preparing a table for his sheep, even as God prepares tables for us. And our cups run over. Well, in essence, the sheep's cup ran over too, if they had a cup. He did anoint their heads with oil. That's a medicinal treatment for scratches and cuts or other bruises that would have been used at the time. Surely goodness and mercy follows me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. It's a spectacular psalm when you think about it, and you analyze how God provides for us. But go back and read the life of David and how he did that. You know, God is our shepherd is not just in this psalm. This isn't the only place. Let's look at a few of the psalms that make reference to it as well. Psalm 74. Verse 1, Psalm 74 and verse 1. This is a contemplation of Asaph, and this is probably the very Asaph who was a contemporary of King David, who David appointed to help with the Levitical choir and orchestra to provide the official music for the tabernacle where the Ark of the Covenant was kept, and later for the temple when Solomon had the temple constructed. O God, why have you cast us off forever? Verse 1. Why does your anger smote against the sheep of your pasture? See, we are the sheep of God's pasture. Israel was the sheep of God's pasture. And the church is the sheep of God's pasture. In essence, we're spiritual Israel. But God's plan is that all nations will become a part of spiritual Israel. Thus, the principle applies to everybody throughout history. Although it may be in the millennium or in the white throne judgment that this is applied to them directly, it does apply to them. They are covered in it. Chapter 77, or Psalm 77, isn't a chapter, they're individual poems. Psalm 77 and verse 20. And here is sort of the summary of the content of the psalm. And it has to do with the Exodus and the wandering years. And so the summary is, you led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. So Israel was like God's flock. They were his sheep in that sense. That's where the sheep and shepherd analogy applied to religious bodies is not unknown, and it is commonly used. We use it too because it comes from the Bible. Psalm 78, just over the page. We have two verses. First, verse 52 of Psalm 78, 52. He made his own people go forth like sheep, and he guided them in the wilderness like a flock. See, God was the shepherd. The Lord is my shepherd, as David said. He understood this. Now, these psalms may, some of them had been written perhaps by David's time, or maybe not, but the stories were there. This is also a contemplation of Asaph, so it seems to have a contemporary authorage to the time of David, but what was being written about was proverbial, that God led Israel like a flock out of Egypt. And then they put that analogy down over in verse 70 of the same psalm. He also chose David, his servant, and took him from the sheepfolds. From following the ewes that had young, he brought him to shepherd Jacob, his people, and Israel, his inheritance. So he shepherded them according to the integrity of his heart and guided them with the skillfulness of his hands. So David himself was appointed to be the shepherd of Israel, using the analogy that David grew up with. And having grown up with it, he knew the nuance of it. Psalm 79, verse 13. Psalm 79, we sort of break into the middle of this one. So we, your people, and sheep of your pasture, will give you thanks forever. We will show forth your praise to all generations. This is a concept we need to grasp. Now, we can slough off the highly urbanized and high-tech sort of elements of our society to step back and contemplate the natural rhythms of the created world and appreciate this concept that God is our shepherd. Even as David was shepherded by God and in David shepherded Israel, God is our shepherd today. Psalm 95. It's amazing how many references there are to this. Psalm 95, verse 7. Starting in verse 6, come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before the Lord, our Maker, the Eternal, our Maker, for He is our God. We are His people of His pasture and the sheep of His hand. I don't know. I just find that to be very comforting. I'm watching my brother work with his sheep. Just to tell you, sort of toss this story in here at this point and turn to, that was 95. Turn back to Psalm 80, if you would. He had a flock of about 300 ewes. So those were the producers, which meant that when they had their lambs in the spring, and there would be a high rate of twins and some triplets, so you would end up with, instead of just 300 ewes and a few rams, you would have perhaps 800 to 900 sheep, depending on how many triplets and how many twins were born. Lambing is an intense process. You spend a lot of time out in the lambing shed making sure that those little baby lambs don't get stepped on, or they get assigned to their own mother, not confused with somebody else who doesn't have her smell on them and doesn't own them. So there's a lot of sort of finessing that goes along in raising, getting the little lambs off to a good start. But it's a beautiful process to see that happen. He had his flock where he had pastures for them, just like David. He would lead them from one pasture to another, except that his pasture was fenced because he couldn't be with them out in the field all the time. So he had cross fences all throughout this large pasturage. He would bring them into one pasture one day. The next day he'd move them to another one and circle, rotate around. And then by the time they get back to the first one, it's growing and healthy and ready to be grazed again. Sometimes they might have to stay there 2 or 3 days to graze it down. And the way he got them out there is he had a lead ewe, and her name was Jamie. And she was a pet. And she was the boss of the flock. It wasn't one of the rams. It was Jamie. She was sort of a natural leader, and he picked her out for that reason. He could see how the other sheep reacted to her. I couldn't tell her apart from the rest of them, but since he was the shepherd, he could tell her apart. And then it was easy when they were in their sheepfold at night. He brought them in every night because of the coyotes, and there was a barn, and then attached to the barn was a high-walled fence that was about 6 feet high, and no way for sheep to get out or coyotes to get in. And that's where they were kept at night. Otherwise, the coyotes would certainly get in there and kill them. He kept watch from, instead of sleeping in the barn, like it we'll read at John 10 at the end of the sermon, where the shepherd sleeps in the doorway. Their house was a little on the rise above that corral, and they could see it, and had yard lights strategically positioned. So the yard lights assisted with the security of the sheep. Whenever there was a disturbance down there, he would hear it, and the chickens would squawk, and the sheep would make noise. And my brother would get up and look out the window, and if he thought he saw a coyote, out came the varmint rifle and the big spotlight, and more than one of the four-legged sheep stealers met its demise right down near the sheep pen, as the shepherd is always on his guard. Let's go back to Psalm 80. I wanted to touch on that one. Give ear, O shepherd of Israel. This is verse 1. Give ear, O shepherd of Israel, you who lead Joseph like a flock. Now, Joseph is the part of Israel that is made up of two tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh. And in our research, Ephraim is the ancestors of the British peoples, and Manasseh is the ancestor of the American peoples. America is one of the origins of the name. America is from Machir. Machir was the son of Manasseh. And Manasseh only had one son, so we're named after his son. Machir went on to have many sons. And you who dwell between the cherubim, shine forth. Lead Joseph like a flock, and dwell between the cherubim, the angels whose wings overstretch God's throne, shine forth before Ephraim, Benjamin, and Manasseh. Stir up your strength and come and save us. So this was a hymn that Dwight Armstrong years ago put to music. I don't think that we have that particular one in our current hymnal. It was in the hymnals years ago. And in Ephraim, Manasseh's, and Benjamin's sight, come thou and save us, awaken thy might, is the lines. You sort of rearrange it to follow the rhythm of the music. Now I want to go back just a little bit here from the Psalms. Let's go to Genesis 48. And here, since we just finished with that one about Joseph, this one is about Joseph as well. This is when God is having Jacob bless Joseph in Genesis 48 and bless his sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. And when I say bless, It is more than just a blessing, it is a prophecy. These are prophetic blessings, the prophecies of what they would be like. So in Genesis 48 and verse 15, notice this. And he blessed Joseph and said, now this is Jacob now, is blessing Joseph, God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has fed me all my life long to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from evil, bless the lads. Let my name be named on them in the name of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. And you say, where's the sheep? It's fed. It's in the third line. The God who has fed me all my life long to this day. You know, we talk about feeding people, but mostly we feed animals. And we provide food for people, but we feed animals. In other words, it's a term used in shepherding. You know, he fed me, just like I fed my flocks. Over in chapter 49, down in verse 24, chapter 49 and verse 24 of Genesis. This is the prophecy about Joseph. Now remember, after he blessed Ephraim and Manasseh and adopted them as sons, so that the tribe of Joseph was technically two tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh, then on his deathbed, Jacob concluded with his prophecies of the 12 tribes. And now he ties Ephraim and Manasseh together under Joseph. In verse 22, Joseph is a fruitful bough by a well. That's 49, verse 22. His branches run over the wall. He reaches out beyond his own borders. Archers have bitterly grieved him, shot at him, and hated him, but his bow remained in strength, and the arm of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. And then the parenthetical at the end. For from there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. So you have the prophecy of the shepherding there, that God would be shepherding and making these things happen. And we know the descendants, and we have the history to show it, the descendants of Ephraim, that half of Joseph's sons, are the British peoples, and Manasseh is the ancestor of the American people. And we can see these prophecies fulfilled. When the prophecies were to reach their apex, which was around 1800 AD, they did. And the British started rising like a rocket as far as their dominance around the other nations around them and in the world. And they ended up with a world empire in short order, all except for the fact they lost 13 colonies and felt very depressed about it for a while until they found that they had India and a few other places. You know, they had to separate. And Ephraim had to be Ephraim, and Manasseh had to be Manasseh. But Ephraim was the power. The British Empire was the power throughout the 1800s, right up until the 1930s. Around 1940, they peaked. And then World War II began. And they held their own, but in the background came Brother Manasseh. And by the end of World War II, which he got into a year late, remember, Manasseh was the superpower and never stopped and just kept escalating its influence and prestige among the nations and its ability to defend what we have defended up to now in America and the other nations that we've defended. We're in turbulence now, and you look at the overall scheme of things. America is like a plane that is having trouble maintaining its flying trim, and we know that's prophecy too. And we know why, because we see the spiritual condition of our nation around us, and we mourn that. But God is our shepherd. God has been our nation's shepherd in one sense, not in the same spiritual sense that he is the shepherd of his church, but he has been a shepherd to the nations of Israel that were the tribes of Israel, and he brought them and fulfilled prophecies. And that doesn't mean as a shepherd he didn't discipline them, because he certainly did. Certainly did. So the Lord is my shepherd. God provides, he shepherds, he guides. He also provides in the sense of provision. Let's look at Psalm 34 for this, and understanding this in relation to the fact that God shepherds us and provides for us as his people spiritually as well. in, you know, in a sense, doubly, because we're in within the boundaries of one of the dominant tribes of Israel in the end time, but most especially, though, because we're his spiritual people, the church. Psalm 34, here we go, verse 10. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, which I came to understand mean I won't lack. The British use the word, want in the sense of needing something. The young lions lack and suffer hunger, verse 10. But those who seek the eternal shall not lack or want any good thing. We will not want. But in American English, we use the word lack instead. In Psalm 49 is a similar term. And looking at how God provides for his people physically and how he provides for us physically too, but also and most especially spiritually. 49. Sorry, not 49. I was looking at the wrong reference here. 84. 11. 84. Psalm 84, just a little exercise there. Turn to another psalm and verse 11. For the Lord God is a sun and shield. The Lord will give grace and glory. No good thing will he withhold from those who walk uprightly. We will not lack. No good thing will he withhold. And you're like, yeah, well, what has God done for us lately? Well, let's look what he did for Israel back in Deuteronomy 2. This is quite remarkable. When he talks about providing, he certainly provided for them then. We read the psalm that said that he shepherded Israel by the hands of Moses and Aaron. Deuteronomy chapter 2. This is quite interesting. Sometimes we may have read this once before or two or twice, but it slips the mind. Verse 7 of Deuteronomy 2, for the Lord your God has blessed you in the work of your hand. He knows your trudging through the great wilderness. Well, Moses would know it too because he trudged with them. These 40 years the Lord your God has been with you and you have lacked nothing. Oh, they thought they lacked sometimes, but they had food, manna everywhere, and in quail. They had water when they needed water. They had all the things they needed. Didn't have Walmart, though. Let me show you why. It's chapter 8. Chapter 8. Walmart couldn't afford to go there. Or any other mart. Not picking on Walmart. We'll start in verse 2 of Deuteronomy 8. And you shall remember, this is Moses, last will and testament. He wrote the book of Deuteronomy about a month before he died. And he was healthy when he died, but God said, you can't go across the Jordan River into the promised land, so you have to die outside of the promised land. And even though he was 120 and he had all his juices in him, in the way it says in the King James, he knew that he was just going to go and lay down and die when it was the time, and it was nearing. So he was giving this final warning and encouragement and admonition to his people to follow God and be faithful. So in verse 2, it says, and you shall remember that the Eternal your God led you all the way these 40 years in the wilderness to humble you and test you to know what was in your heart. And you know, God is leading his church in the past 40 years and more, but the past 40 years of our experience and more, to do the same thing. To humble us, to test us, to know what's in our heart. And whether you would keep his commandments or not. Dittos for us. And we look back and we can see what has happened in our time. In verse 3, so he humbled you and allowed you to hunger. And then he fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that a man shall not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. Manna was without any precedent. Never been done before, and God provided it. But notice verse 4. This is the Walmart connection. Your garments did not wear out on you, nor did your foot swell these 40 years. Now, the foot swelling, meaning that your shoes don't fit. You have to have different shoes. Well, if your garments aren't wearing out, it implies the shoes weren't wearing out either. So what you wore at the Exodus is what you wore at the crossing of the Jordan River. They didn't wear out. Now maybe you outgrew them, and so somebody else is wearing them, but they haven't worn out. And if you were an adult, you know, a young adult, when the Exodus took place, you're still wearing the same exact fashions from 40 years earlier. There was no market for consumer goods. No market at all. But you just have to stop and think about it. The cloth didn't wear out. We know that cloth, leather wears out. But none of it wore out. God provided for his people. If God does that for Israel, brethren, what can he do for us? He can help us when we need it too. And that's the encouragement of knowing that God is our shepherd. Now we go back to the New Testament, and Christ picks up this very theme in John 10 and adds elements that we need to keep very clearly in mind ourselves. John chapter 10. We'll start right in verse 1. We actually have to read through not quite all the chapter, but about a half of it. Most assuredly, I say to you, he who does not enter by the sheepfold by the door, but climbs in some other way, the same as a thief and a robber. In other words, you will have false teachers. You will have those who want to steal the church or wreck the church, you know, in time to come. He's giving this admonition to his disciples. And so they are the ones who are going to be the pioneers of the New Testament Church of God. See, the shepherd doesn't sneak in. He comes through the door. But anybody else that comes in any other way, if there's anything out of the ordinary, then beware. For he who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him, the doorkeeper opens. And you think, well, what do you mean? There's a doorkeeper and the shepherd comes? Yeah, there might be two or three or four shepherds that pool their resources to have a sheepfold where they can have the sheep bedded down safely at night away from thieves and away from, you know, canines and felines. And then one of them will be the doorkeeper. Just, oh, it's so-and-so. He gets to come in. You know, I mean, we got a sheep in here, so... the doorkeeper opens, and the sheep hear his voice, and he calls his own sheep by name, and he leads them. My brother did that. He tested this out. He made a pet out of the one I told you about, Jamie. And when it was time to take the sheep down to the pasture for the day, he would stand at the gate, and he would call her. And she would be wherever out in the flock, and they were all crowded into this large pen with the walls around them. And she would start talking back to him, calling to him. And as she called to him, she'd start weaving her way through the flock, and the flock would start to pivot and fall in behind her. Even the ones that were close to him would move around, and so they would fall in behind Jamie, and then he would open the gate, and they would walk out, and she would walk right beside him, you know, talking in this, you know, bah, bah. I don't know how to imitate a sheep very well, but that was kind of how it was. She had a kind of a guttural, deep guttural voice with an odd rhythm to it, you know, very distinctive. But he noticed that she was a sheep that the other sheep tended to follow. You know, there's a pecking order within all kinds of livestock. In our milk cow pen, the milk cows were the queens. And any other cattle that were in there, better understand that. Things will be fine if you understand that. Won't be so good if you don't. So she would follow along. The sheep would all then string out behind them. They'd walk down through the pastures and come to the one that he had the gate open for, and into the gate they would go. And then they would graze that day. And when it was time to come in at night, he would go out and call to Jamie. And wherever she was, she'd start talking. And as she talked, then they all fell in behind her like a funnel, and then they followed right out. Except one day. He had an appointment in Rapid City at about an hour, a little over an hour away from where he lived. So he had to bring him in earlier in the afternoon. He couldn't leave him out over through the rest of the day without, you know, being there to watch over him. So he called her, and she came in, except there was one, and all the flock followed, except for one young ram who didn't want to come. And my brother tried to round him up, and he wouldn't be rounded up. He stayed. He wanted to stay out in that pasture by himself. He ignored the queen of the flock, ignored the peer pressure, the positive peer pressure to follow with the flock, and he stayed out there. My brother spent 20 or 30 minutes. He let Jamie lead the flock on down and into the pen, you know, the nighttime pen. And he tried to get that one, and finally ran out of time. He says, well, I have to get him when I get back. Well, that was a lot easier to get him when he got back. There were pieces of it. Coyotes moved in, and they had him for lunch. And that was the end of that. But there was also a lesson. There's also a lesson in that for us, isn't there? He didn't want to be a part of the flock, and what do you know? He got his wish. We don't want that to happen to us, so, you know, we learn from those things. Anyway, Christ goes on to say, and when he brings out his own sheep in verse 4, he goes before them, and the sheep follow him, and they know his voice. Yet they will by no means follow a stranger, but will flee from him, for they don't know the voice of strangers. Do we know the voice of the shepherd, of the shepherds that God has established? That's what we have to ask, and we have to analyze what we're hearing. Is this a voice of one who is truly a shepherd of God's people, teaching God's truth, reinforcing the true faith of Jesus Christ? Or is this too much more akin to the kind of shepherding we see in society, which doesn't even know God's way of life? And Jesus said to them again, most assuredly, I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. You know, there's a door into the sheep cote or the sheep pen. I'm the door. They have to come through me. All who come before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not hear them. I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved and will go in and out and find pasture. No other religion is the true religion except God's truth. And we have to have that very clear in our minds. I mean, it doesn't mean we're disrespectful of other people. We were deceived before as well. But they are, and mankind historically has been. It's nothing new by any means. But we can't mistake false religion for the true religion. The thief does not go out except to steal, in verse 10, and to kill and destroy. I have come that they might have life and have it more abundantly. Remember that phrase? We use that phrase quite a lot, that they may have life and have it more abundantly. Because the abundance is in the spiritual understanding, not necessarily in the physical wealth. You know, sometimes we have a little extra physical wealth. Certainly we're blessed for tithing and so on, but the greatest blessing is the spiritual blessing of understanding the truth of God and understanding His Word and knowing what He wants us to do. I am the good shepherd, Christ says. The good shepherd gives his life for the sheep. But a hireling, he who is not the shepherd, one who does not own the sheep, sees the wolf coming and he leaves the sheep and he flees. And the wolf catches the sheep and scatters them. The hireling flees because he's a hireling. He's not invested in the sheep. He doesn't care about them. I am the good shepherd, and I know my sheep, and I am known by my own. So we have to be sure that we understand and know our Savior, who is the head of the church. As the Father knows me, even so I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep. And other sheep I have that are not of this fold, and to them I must bring, them I also must bring, and they will hear my voice, and there will be one flock and one shepherd. That was a prophecy that reaches all the way down to us. There are yet sheep that are not of my fold. And it would be true even in the first century as the apostles would go out that there were lost sheep of Israel and lost sheep that weren't of Israel. There were Gentiles, non-Israelites, and they would be called into the church. And then you can apply it in time, down through the centuries, down to the 20th and now the 21st century, that there are sheep that God is calling now. Sheep meaning, like ourselves, brethren, that God calls to repentance to be a part of the true flock of Jesus Christ and God the Father. Therefore, my Father loves me because I lay down my life for that I may take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down myself. I have the power to lay it down and the power to take it up, and this command I receive from my Father. In a way, you can see a comparison, although in a different way, because Christ's sacrifice was necessary for the forgiveness of sin. But he was willing to go through that. David put his life at risk in taking on the bear and the lion to defend his flock. And likewise, we need to, we don't always have to die in the process of giving our life for those that we see as God's people and God's way and God's work. Now let's go back. Our final little note we have is Hebrews. The ministry, by extension of Christ, are the shepherds now. That's what pastor is, another term for shepherd. So we have a responsibility. The Apostle Peter wrote about that in 1 Peter 5. That's a good section to read on that, first few verses. But Christ is the good shepherd, as we've already seen reiterated. But here is our final passage. It's in Hebrews 13. And this one is a reference that brings us back to the title, God is our shepherd. God the Father and God the Son. Hebrews 13. Here we go. And it's in verse 20 to 21. Now may the God of peace, who brought up our Lord Jesus from the dead, resurrected him, that great shepherd of the sheep, through the blood of the everlasting covenant, make you complete to every good work to do his will, according to in you what is well-pleasing in his sight, through Jesus Christ, to whom be glory and forever and ever. Amen. When you read the sentence carefully, the great shepherd of the sheep is applying to the Father. And yet we know that Christ is also the good shepherd. Christ and the Father both shepherd us. You know, we had this scripture or the sermon we went through a few months ago where we go through the New Testament and see how many times is Christ and the Father that are mentioned together. And Christ is our shepherd directly. God the Father is our shepherd as well. In other words, the God family shepherds us and leads us. We, therefore, brethren, need to follow the true God of the Bible.